beauty and skincare is always a hot topic around here, and today I want to tell you about a new product line I've discovered that I think you will like, Exponent Beauty. Listeners of the show will receive 20% off their purchase. More details on that in a minute. Exponent Beauty is a skincare brand with a line of activated anti-aging serums that are clinically proven to reduce fine lines and wrinkles. The beauty of Exponent Beauty is their innovative form factor. The powders are activated with a quadruple hyaluronic acid serum in their patented precision-dosed dispenser. The packaging is gorgeous, and the dispenser itself is refillable, so it has also reduced plastic waste. Exponent Beauty's line of serums can be found in med spas, and dermatologists' office around the country. The line is dermatologist recommended and clinically proven to reduce those fine lines and wrinkles, and to increase brightness and radiance, and to firm skin without irritation. No more expired or underutilized products with Exponent Beauty, just high-quality skincare with ingredients that work. Go to exponentbeauty.com and use code TELL20 for 20% off a purchase of $100 or more. That's Exponent, E-X-P-O-N-E-N-T, Beauty, B-E-A-U-T-Y.com and use code TELL20, T-E-L-L, the numbers 20, for 20% off your purchase of $100 or more. Welcome to the 10 Things to Tell You podcast. I'm Laura Tremaine. I always have at least 10 things to tell you, and you have 10 things to tell. This is a show where we believe that sharing yourself will make you less lonely. Here's the thing. I know a lot of really interesting people. Smart people, creative people, people who are quietly and not so quietly changing the world. And while I love being in the orbit of such interesting people, I've never quite found a way to have them on the show. It never quite fit exactly what 10 Things to Tell You was doing over the years. And this show has morphed, and I like to offer a variety of episodes, but, you know, if there wasn't always a direct point to the conversation, I just wasn't exactly sure how to incorporate it into episodes. Until I was planning for the 200th episode that aired back at the end of 2023. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to do to commemorate 200 episodes of this show that I have poured my heart and soul into, I came up with the idea of asking people what their one thing they would tell to others. Like, if you just had one thing to share, what would it be? The show is called 10 Things to Tell You, and I have kind of my 10 main messages that I really hit on over and over the years, but I wanted to ask past guests for episode 200, I wanted to ask them what their one big thing that they could share with listeners, what that would be. And so for episode 200, I got some of the most amazing responses to that question. I reached out to a lot of past guests of the show, and I was just delighted by what their responses were. And that became a bit of a light bulb moment for me of a way that I could incorporate some of the very interesting people that I already know or that I meet to come beyond the show and share their one thing, share parts of their life story, share some of the wisdom that they have gained. I felt like I finally had an avenue for that invitation. And so I'm introducing a series of episodes that I'm just going to sprinkle in to the normal 10 Things to Tell You episodes, where I'm inviting guests to share their one thing with us. And I'm kicking off this series with my friend, Amy Harris. I met Amy just last year when our girls became friends at middle school, and then they became teammates on the volleyball team. And these facts alone have brought us very close together in the last year or so. And getting to know Amy, she is absolutely fascinating. She is so smart. She is so funny. She works on some really interesting projects. And I knew that sitting down with her would be a great conversation. Amy is a writer and producer on some of the most iconic shows of our lifetime. She is a showrunner. She is a mom. All of these things we're going to get to in this conversation. And she drops so many nuggets of wisdom in this hour. I feel like this is the type of episode that you're going to want to go back and listen to twice. Amy is the perfect person to kick off this One Thing series. And I hope you enjoy our conversation about Hollywood and lucky breaks and getting the right message at the right time and what she's hoping to teach her daughter about chasing her own dreams. Amy, welcome to 10 Things to Tell You.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
I love recording with friends because it's a totally different vibe. And we get to be in person, which is a treat for me because I so often record online. So we're in my podcast studio in my house, and we have been friends. We've gotten pretty close in the last couple of years because our daughters have become really close. But there's a lot of your story that I don't know.
Yes, I am more than just a mom, it turns out. Sometimes I forget that.
Where did you grow up?
So I grew up right outside of Washington, D.C., near your husband.
Yeah.
And in Bethesda, Maryland. Was there, you know, through high school and then went to college and immediately moved to New York and spent a lot of my formative growing up years, which I consider my 20s and 30s to be, in Manhattan.
Why New York after D.C.?
So my father insisted that I take a year off between college and law school. He said, we'll pay for law school, but you have to take a year off, go explore some other avenues. I don't want you to go to law school because you don't know what else you want to do with your life. Both my parents were lawyers. So he was like, you should go to Aspen and ski. And I thought about it, and I had always really wanted to live in New York. That had been a dream for a very long time, and I wasn't sure. I sort of had ideas about what I wanted to do as a lawyer, and that would have taken me back to D.C. So I decided to move to New York. And then I never went to law school.
Do you think that he knew in his infinite wisdom as a parent that that is what was going to happen?
I don't think he knew that. He had gone into the Navy after college so he could pay for college and law school. And I think he just thought by the time he got there, he really knew it was what he wanted. So do I think at the end of the day, he wanted to be sure that is what I wanted? Yes, absolutely. But I think he thought I would come back. As I went from a regular job with health insurance to I'm going to work on a television show that might last 6 to 8 weeks to I'm unemployed and I'm writing. There was some nerves there for them, I think. They were, you know, pretty traditional in terms of like you get a job and you work at a place for a long time and you move up the ranks. So, but my dad was very charismatic and excited by all things that he didn't know about. So he was kind of freaked out when I was like, I'm not going to law school at first, but he totally embraced everything I did as I went along. So it was much easier for me knowing my parents were behind me, supporting me.
Yeah, I think now that I'm a parent, I think of some of those type of things that my parents did similarly. Like I think about them differently now. So when I was graduating from high school, I really did not want to go to college. I did not love school, even though I was decent at it and I had gotten a scholarship to college, but I did not want to go. And my parents were like, you have to go for 1 year. You have to do 1 year and then we'll readdress. And I took them at face value. And I actually do think they meant it, to be honest. But I was also like, well, now I can look back and feel like, oh, yeah, they knew that I was going to go and get involved and love it and not leave, which is exactly what happened. It's a risk that they took, I guess, but I think about it differently now than I did then. So I was thinking about the way your dad did that also, if he had an inkling.
Maybe. He really, I think he just wanted to know. I think at the time, so many people were just going to law school because it was like they didn't really know what they wanted out of their lives. And that was like another round of school to kind of keep you from figuring it out. And I remember I had gotten into Georgetown Law and I had deferred, and I had to call the head of admissions to say I wanted to defer for one more year because I was really loving New York. And his name is Andy. And he said to me, Amy, stop deferring your life. It's okay. Let this go. You can reapply if you decide you want to come back. But you're just kind of holding on to something and waiting. And I think at the end of the day, that's holding you back from kind of really exploring what you want to do.
Wait, the Georgetown guy said all that?
The Georgetown guy said that to me, which I thought was amazing. I had a lot of like really like lucky moments. Like my grandmother, when I was trying to go to New York, my dad was helping me get a job as a paralegal. And I happened to get a job, an interview at Vanity Fair magazine to be an editorial assistant. And I got that job. And my parents were in Mendocino, where there still was no cell phone service because they were visiting my aunt. My grandmother was with me, and she's an artist. And I said, I don't know what to do. I really think I want to take the Vanity Fair job. And she said, you're a creative artist like me. You take that Vanity Fair job, your dad's going to be bummed, and you're going to make half the money. So you're going to have to find a different kind of apartment than you thought you were. But it's okay because you have to explore this. So I had like a couple of great little moments in those first formative few years right after college where the right people said the right things to me. And I also listened. I heard it and chased it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I feel very lucky. Like I had... And my dad was so proud of me. Like anybody who ever met me, who met me through my dad, like knew more about me than sometimes I was like, how much does my father talk about me? He has a big job. Like, how is he actually spending all this time, you know, being proud of his kids? But that's who he was too. So, yeah, I got lucky.
So was the Vanity Fair job your first job in New York?
First job out of college.
Okay, that's like a dream.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
And what's an editorial assistant do, to be honest? I don't know.
So I worked for one of the editors who was, she worked with all the writers. And then I actually worked for two editors. One was actually editing with the writers. They would work on story ideas together. They'd come up with, and then I was really just assisting her, you know, making travel plans for the writers, doing research for the writers if they needed research done before they went, ordering lunches for people, all the grunt work. There was a thing called the gossip pack, which every like 3 weeks you had to come in early and do, and you would cut out all the gossip columns from all the New York magazines and newspapers and put a pack together and then put them in everybody's desks. Because a lot of the good stories came from a small story about whatever was happening in Page Six. Suddenly you thought, oh, that could be a really cool story for the magazine, or this is an up-and-coming star that we might want to cover. So I tried to use the job, well, A, to go to parties, because having Vanity Fair as access, you could get into like lots of really cool parties and cool clubs. So I definitely used it for that. But I really tried to use it to learn about writing and the editing process. And my first boss, Clara Glovcheska, who then became the editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Traveler for a very long time, she hired me and she said, you seem to have sort of no skill sets that make you write for this job, but I really like you and you seem smart and you're going to learn. And that's what I've always done now when I hire people is like, I just think like when I'm creating a writer's room, I'm like, it's a dinner party, right? It's a SWAT team dinner party. It's like some people are going to be great writers. Some people are going to have great stories. Some people are going to be really good at structure. Some people are going to be great at dialogue. But I have to sit around a table with people that I'm going to really enjoy spending 10 hours a day with building story because you want that trust and some good emotional energy. So she really taught me early on it was like a vibe. Like the resume can be one thing, their samples can be one thing, but it's the vibe in the room that tells you whether or not you're going to click.
That's such smart advice. I feel like we're just at the beginning of this conversation and you've already had like so many people who have dropped wisdom on you.
Well, that my whole thing is like just always be listening because, you know, they always say with actors, like the best actors are the best listeners. They're not the best performers of their lines. They're like hearing what the other person is saying and it's affecting them. So I also think that's kind of important as a person in the world, is like to be able to listen and mm-hmm. really hear what people are saying to you. And then take it, if like I always say to people, this is a big piece of advice I give writers, like, don't take any notes from anybody that you don't like unless they're paying you, and then you have to take the notes. But if you give me a script to read and I give you notes and you disagree, like, you have to like hear it, take it in, don't be defensive, and then take what works for you and makes sense. And I think that's important just with every kind of advice you get, parenting, writing.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you feel like you're able to apply that also in life? Or is it easy for you to disregard notes or advice or thoughts in a professional setting than in like a personal one?
I think, you know, writing is so emotional and personal. It can feel very immediately sort of defensive when you get notes that make you feel uncomfortable about how people read your material. But because I also produce and I know that it's much bigger than me, it's, you know, it's a script, it's actors, it's production, it's editing. I have learned to really try to absorb notes in a really like metabolizing in a very slow, stable way, as opposed to kind of a freak out. Whereas I find in life and parenting, because it feels more sort of heart, I don't metabolize necessarily as well, to be honest. I tend to get to sort of frantic much faster and have to kind of remind myself to like take this in, step away for a beat. That's what they always say on a notes call. Like, just say, okay, yeah, that's a thanks for that. Like, I'll look into that, or I'll think about it. And it's not dismissive. It's actually really just like, I want to process this. And I sometimes don't do that as well in my personal life. I'm working on it still. We're evolving people, right?
Aren't we all?
Here's hoping. If we're not, I don't know what the point is.
With sunshine, outdoor activities, and so many fun things to do outside, it is impossible not to enjoy all of these good weather days up ahead. Of course, we all know that more sun and fun means more sweating, and yes, more odor. That's why I'm excited to tell you about Lumi. Lumi is the first of its kind in the full body deodorant world and is seriously safe to use on any and every part of your body. It was created by an OBGYN who saw firsthand how regular body odor was being misdiagnosed and mistreated. I especially love that Lumi deodorant is baking soda and paraben free. It is also pH balanced for safe use on all areas of your body. You can choose from a variety of fresh scents like clean tangerine, lavender sage, and toasted coconut. Lumi's starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice, like a mini body wash or deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with code U at LumiDeodorant.com. That equates to 40% off your starter pack when you visit Lumi, L-U-M-E, deodorant, D-E-O-D-O-R-A-N-T, .com and use code U-Y-O-U. It's not every day that you find a product that you truly love and want to shout about from the rooftops. Well, friends, I have found something that I am genuinely excited to share with you today, and that is Born Shoes. Born Shoes are made with the best top-quality leather with functional stitching and flexibility. They are lightweight, but they're also supportive. They are great for all casual occasions, extremely comfortable, and especially good for travel. The brand recently gifted me a pair of the Ithaca-style sandals. Of course, they are beautiful. The footbed has extra foam for added comfort and with a slight heel for lift. I am positive that I could walk all over London in this pair of shoes, just like I did in my Born sandals last summer. Born Shoes offers sandals, flats, boots, and heels in several styles and color choices. Take comfort in Born Shoes. Every season, they make high-quality shoes that feel as good as they look. With artistic touches, unparalleled craftsmanship, and exquisite materials, Born designs shoes to satisfy the demands of every lifestyle. Go to bornshoes.com for a 15% discount plus free ground shipping on all full-price shoes when you use my promo code TELL. That's Born, B-O-R-N, shoes, S-H-O-E-S.com, and use promo code TELL, T-E-L-L, for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for a limited time. So how long were you at Vanity Fair?
So I was at that job for 2 years. And then there was no real room to sort of move up because there was editorial assistants and then these very senior editors. So I realized I needed to move on. And then I spent 1 year in a very weird job working at what actually ended up becoming Fox News. But I didn't understand that's actually where I was working. So Fox was trying to build a 1 hour news magazine show, like a 60 Minutes. And that was the first time I actually, because I'm from a very political DC family, that was the first time I realized, like, oh, this is scary. Like, media controls things and tells stories in ways that I wasn't that comfortable with. Like, they would be doing Newt Gingrich's book, and then they'd do a puff piece on Newt Gingrich. And I was like, oh, I don't like this. I don't want to participate in this. I was like, I've got to get out of here. And then Darren Star, who created Sex and the City, he was actually doing a show called Central Park West about a magazine and about the editorial assistants, the young people at the magazine. And our families had been friends forever, long before I was born. And he asked if he could sit down with me. And I was such a huge fan. Like, he had done 90210 and Melrose Place. I thought he was like a god. Like, I couldn't believe, like, he saw me and he's like, oh, Amy, can I take you to breakfast and talk to you about your time at Vanity Fair? Because I'm writing this script about young people, like a hot magazine. I was out of my mind. I was so excited.
Because you were, what, like 25?
I was 24.
24.
Yeah. And he took me out to breakfast and I told him the stuff that I had done and the fun things that had happened to me. And I decided to write him a letter and just say, if you decide, because there wasn't really email, I said, if you decide you are filming this in New York and there's like any PA assistant jobs of any sort, I would love to come work on the show. And I mailed it out and his assistant called me and said, I'm actually not planning to move to New York because they were in LA and Darren offered me the job to be his assistant. So my first job in TV, the way I know TV now, is working for Darren as his assistant that didn't work. But it was a year that I learned a ton and he bought the rights to Sex and the City that year. And that sort of is how my career began.
Wait, so did you move to LA to assist him?
No, it all happened in New York.
Everything was in New York.
Everything was in New York. So Central Park West shot in New York, and then this might just be too much of a tangent, but so in between when he bought the Sex and the City columns from Candace and him writing the pilot, I didn't have a job. So I went to work for the Clinton Gore campaign in 1996. So I spent sort of 10 months doing that and then actually worked in the White House during the impeachment, which was really a wild thing.
Why would you say this is too much of a tangent?
It's just a weird, I had a very weird few years where I was, at one point I had decided, so I really enjoyed my time working for the Clintons, and Mrs. Clinton at the time was looking for a deputy social secretary. And I was interviewing for the job and I was going to stay in D.C. My parents were very happy. Then the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke and everyone around Mrs. Clinton people who were planning to leave decided not to leave. They really wanted to protect her during that process. And so they were like, the job might be available in 6 months. And I was like, okay. And I wasn't sure what to do. And then Darren was like, they got the Sex and the City pilot greenlit. So I went to work on the pilot. And then I was like, oh, this is my life. And I remember seeing my friend Capricia, who was the social secretary, and she would always laugh and be like, I bet you really wish you'd stayed in D.C. Because she, you know, Sex and the City just became this like insane thing that I was on that, you know, it was life changing, obviously, to be on that show.
It was life-changing to watch that show.
No, thanks. Well, that's, yeah. I mean, it's such a strange thing for me because I was on that show and Darren and Michael Patrick King, he was the person who really encouraged me to write. He was like, you have to start writing. You're so talented. He always, you know, we have a story that, like, he's like, I definitely did not say that, but I know he did. I was, like, reading somebody's script that had come in. And he said, how is it? Because he had been in a room. And I said, it's okay. Like, I think you're going to feel like it needs a lot of work. And he said something to me like, if you, like, not saying like, if you think it's so easy, you should try, because I wasn't saying it was easy. He said, but said something to the extent of like, you should try it and see what it's like, because it's brutal kind of to be a writer. And he's like, I would never have said something like that. So I don't know if I, whatever I heard, it made me start writing. So I started writing on the side. I would go home from work and I started writing. And
because you were on this show, but you were like an assistant?
I was an assistant and an associate producer. So I worked with Sarah Jessica. I did all the voiceover with her. So I would sit in the studio with her and do all the voiceover. And
which is like the famous part of the show.
It was so fun. I mean, it was fantastic. And that was also like a weird thing, because it was such an important part of the show, but it was like, we would be like scheduling it into her 16-hour day at hour like 16 and a half. So it was like this very tired, long day. And then we would go into this room and she would record, and she was so amazing. Like, I would be like, do it three times just so we have three versions. It's not like she needed a lot of, you know, direction. She so was in the character always. But it was a very fun part of my job, was to sort of, like, I kind of looked at my job at that point as like, where you see holes, just seep in and like help out so that there aren't holes. And I think that's like something people don't realize. Like, it's a little bit thinking ahead, but it's also just like, I see a problem. I think I can solve it. I'm going to do that. Or so there was a bunch of stuff I did in that job that wasn't, it was nebulous, like what it was a producer. I was given a producer title because I was sort of doing a bunch of different things. But then I would be on set a lot and taking notes. And Michael would always take me out to pitch episodes. I'd sit at dinner and he'd pitch me the episode. And I'd be like kind of making like a question mark face. And he'd be like, your face tells me everything. Like, that story isn't working. And I was living that life more than I think almost anybody else on the crew or writing team. Like, I was in Manolo Blahniks. I was going to the Vanity Fair. Part of my life had set me up well to be one of, you know, to have that kind of insight. But I wasn't writing. I was just producing.
Well, and what you're describing about, I love how you said, I'm going to seep into any holes that I see, because first of all, I can see how that would make you stand apart in general. Secondly, I think that's not what the current generation of 20-somethings is doing necessarily. I mean, I could be misreading it, and I'm not trying to, you know, everybody bashes the generation after them or whatever, but it's more like, I think that culturally we have gotten more like, that's not my job, or I'm going to stay in my own lane, or, you know, sort of those kind of ideas, instead of pitching in, wearing different hats, doing all the things. I think those people are a rarity.
I think that's true. I've noticed, and I have noticed, like, the people who have come and worked for me who have done similarly to what I did, which is seep in wherever it was sort of necessary but not necessarily asked, they've all gone on to just explode in terms of their careers. And I've noticed that the people who sort of feel a little bit more like, this is what I'm doing and this is my job. And look, there is a fine line. I actually think I hope I'm a good boss. I've heard people tell me I'm a fair and good boss, but there are a lot of people who abuse the system and abuse their staff. So boundaries are super important. But then on the other hand, like on Sex and the City, like, we just became such a family and all the writers felt so close to each other. Like on a Friday night, if we were filming, we call them Fratterdays, because you would film late into the night. You'd shoot your nights, Thursday nights and Friday nights. So we'd wrap at 5 a.m. on Saturday mornings when the sun was coming up, because there was no more night to shoot. And a lot of us would just stay, even if it wasn't our episode, because A, we were learning and we really liked each other. And it just felt like, that's what you do to create this. And I do think it made the show what it was, that we were a family, the writers, and like the way we sort of seeped in and hammocked each other when we needed help on the set. Kind of the way we wrote those characters, I think, really deepened because of that. And I think what happens when people really just want to stay in their lanes, and a little bit like what I worried about when we were in Zoom writers' rooms a lot, was the work gets done, but I don't know if the magic sprinkle happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing that, like, I sometimes think is missing when people just want to stay in their lanes and only have boundaries. You do have to have boundaries and appropriate ones, but I think you can... It's exciting to go outside the lines because I think you learn a lot. And then I think you also, like, I do think product gets better because of it.
Yeah, I can see the difference between shows I worked on back in the day, projects that Jeff makes, the difference between we're just making a thing and we're making a magical thing.
Totally. Totally. And look, some shows just aren't magical things. It's, you know, I don't know. It's the algorithm thing of it all now, like how to make a hit show, the tech companies, like, it's like there's no algorithm. It's like sometimes there's magic and sometimes there's not. But the magical ones, when you know you're in it, the good news is most people, everybody kind of comes together because they know it's magic.
How'd you go from being the assistant or a producer to writing on Sex and the City?
So I wrote a spec script of Sex and the City when I would go home after my 16-hour days, I would go home and write. And I said to Michael, like, I don't obviously expect to get a job on this show, but I think I really would like to pursue writing. And if you would read the script, I would be really grateful. And he read it. And I knew I had done an okay job because Darren, who I had not wanted to ask to read it because I felt he would maybe just feel like, oh, God, if I have to read this stinky thing and it's bad, then I have to look her in the face and be just embarrassed for her and for me. I knew Michael would be more like, it's not great, but let's talk about why it's not great. But I knew Darren would be like, ugh, this is just embarrassing for her and for me. He was like, I heard you have a script. Why haven't you given it to me? And I was like, oh, maybe it's not terrible. I mean, it wasn't great, I don't think. But there were some really good ideas in it that we ended up... I had Samantha become a lesbian, and then we ended up using that in the show. And so...
Wait, you originated that?
Well, I had had this idea that, like, she would be going after, like, a lesbian singer as a client, but then she would fall for her. And then they did a very different version of that in the show, but it, like, I think triggered the idea to have that become part of Samantha's storyline. And it made sense for her. She was somebody who was so open. Like, why wouldn't she end up dating a woman?
That right.
Felt really realistic to all of us. So then I was like, okay, I hope maybe I can try to get an agent. And I knew a bunch of agents because I worked with so many agents while on the show as a producer. But then Michael said, like, we want to move you to the writing staff. And that was huge. And so huge, I actually didn't even understand. I mean, I cried for the weeks I was writing my first draft because I was so scared. Like, I was just, every morning I would, like, cry for 2 hours and then write. Because I just knew, like, a lot was on the line. What I hadn't realized was, like, I kind of gave up my other job for the writing gig. So, like, if it really hadn't worked, it would have been, like, incredibly hard for me to move back to my other job in the on the show. But luckily, it worked out. And my first draft, truthfully, I think was pretty mediocre. And Michael said to me, as he was giving me notes, I just want to be clear, the first draft is not what tells me if you're a good writer. It's how you take the notes.
Mm.
And that was super helpful, like super helpful, because I was scared, but I also understood, like, okay, I have to metabolize these notes and understand what it is. And one of the storylines that we had didn't work at all. And I didn't understand totally why it didn't work until we talked it through. And then I was like, oh, I see. I wrote it the way we pitched it in the room, but it didn't land. But it took me years to figure out why, when you're in a room and everyone pitches ideas and it all looks like it's working and you write an outline when in it, like sometimes in a script, you're like, this isn't good. Like, this has to go. But it took me a long time to have the confidence to sort of understand that.
Because in all writers' rooms are different. Shows do this in all kinds of different ways. But was it you came together in the room, brainstormed ideas or storylines or, you know, snippets of dialogue or whatever, and then one writer puts together the episode?
So the way I learned on Sex and the City and the way I do it now, the room breaks the episode together. Oftentimes the showrunner, who was Michael when I was on the writing staff, will come in with a lot of ideas. But like we break the whole season on the board. So it's like episodes 1 through 18.
Like, this is what's going to happen.
This is the general arc of where Carrie's storyline is going to go for this season. And Michael has a lot of very strong instincts, insights, ready to go when you walk into the room. And then he's ready to kind of hear everybody else's ideas around that, but also maybe it takes you to the left or to the right. So we arc first. That's the sort of putting all those general, you know, Carrie is with Aiden, starts to have an affair with Big, reveals, you know, we arced that whole season. We knew what that season looked like. Then each episode, you're really like, what is this? What is actually happening in each of these episodes? We break it all together. And I used to call it like biorhythms. Like if Carrie's in a relationship, then maybe Charlotte's breaking up with someone, Miranda's single, and Samantha is on the tail end of a relationship. So that every character was sort of experiencing something slightly different, unless the episode was really about they're all going through the same thing. And then you really broke down each person's storyline into beats. You go off, you write a beat sheet, and then you do an outline, and you get notes on that, and then you go off and write the script. But like to the very end, like on my first drafts in particular, Michael would sit with me before the table reads and help me do punch up of jokes. And I mean, you never went to the table with a script. Like the great news I always felt and what I hope I've done on the shows that I've run is you feel ownership of your scripts, but you know it was this beautiful team effort. And if it doesn't work at the table, like it's not your fault. It's like we did work and it didn't always work out exactly how we hoped. Mm-hmm. And if it was at the table read and it did great, you could feel very proud, but you also understood this was this amazing team effort also. So that's kind of how I've tried to work as a showrunner also. But Michael would often do like a huge pass on a script if it just felt like after the table read, it wasn't quite working. Like, and that you just were like, yeah, you know more than I do. I trust.
So I came to Sex and the City a little bit late because I didn't have HBO in like my high school years. Yeah. I was in a small town. We didn't even have access. I didn't have Fox either.
Crazy.
And so I had never seen 90210 or Melrose Place or anything.
Oh my God.
So I came to Sex and the City. I guess I was in college. And so I was late to it. I caught up, believe me. But I'm curious if you knew, because it was such a cultural phenomenon, if you knew that it was magic as you were making it, the show itself, and then did that add like a pressure? Because then as it went on, you know, like fans get really invested on like Carrie's movements, if you will. And so if that affected you or if you were able to sort of stay in your bubble of like, no, this is what the show is, like regardless of how the audience receives it or not.
Well, the first season was not a phenomenon. The first season was small, and we were not sure we were getting a second season. Mm. But when we did the premiere party, people kept coming up to me saying, like, this is my life. And then they would tell a story that wasn't exactly or really at all like what Carrie had gone through. But I sensed we were hitting some really deep chord about being single in New York that felt very exciting. Like, so I was like, I think this is something. But there was crazy stuff. Like, we would shoot something and be like directors would be doing like a serious version. And then we'd have to come down and have to help like reconfigure it so that it was funny. Cause the tone of it was very unique for the time. It was like very rare to see something that had like so much comedy, but then also had a lot of heart under it. Mm-hmm. And figuring that out in the first season, I think was a big, and I was a part of that, but Michael and Darren were really working and Sarah Jessica were really working so hard to find the tone of the show. And it changed as years went on and grew and became, I think, what I was most proud of in the show is it kept evolving. The way we, like, the characters evolved, how we told story. Like, we had those men on the street scenes. Like, she'd ask the question and then it would go to four people who either had a joke version of their answer or a serious version. Like, we got rid of those and that was like a huge discussion about whether to get rid of those or not. And one of the reasons, honestly, why we got rid of it, it was like a day's worth of production that we were giving to these like little tidbits that were kind of taking away from our stories with the women. But there was a huge debate as to whether to remove that. Mm-hmm. And then it really did come down to money. Like, it was like, well, that takes a whole day away from filming our stories with the four women. It doesn't feel worth it. And on the look back, like, I never miss that. Like, they seem sort of like too jokey. Mm-hmm. So I was sort of processing that first season, like maybe this could be something when the premiere came out. And then we lived in New York. And so anytime I came to LA, I started to understand like how big the show was, because people would be bored and not interested in me at dinner parties and then find out what I did and then would be like all in. And I was like, oh, the show must be something big. And then all of a sudden, like it was like, it was crazy. Like when we went to, when we had premieres here, and like it just became this huge thing. And I'm just so grateful there was no TikTok, social media, texting, Twitter, because we did stay in our bubble. We just wrote what we wanted to be talking about. And I've tried to do that even, you know, I've worked on a bunch of shows since that where I've been annihilated on Twitter, like kind of frightened for my life with angry fans, like screaming at me and saying like, this is Amy and it's a computer. And then they have a gun to the computer. I'm like, oh my God, what is happening?
Wait, really?
People go crazy. People, fans of shows feel like they own the show after the first season where they love it. And it's beautiful because you've done something that matters. But then there's like, if you twist it in any way that they don't like or the way they didn't hope, like those fans on Twitter go get very upset because it's like they're in it. But what I've always tried to do and what we were able to totally do on Sex and the City is just write the show we wanted, the stories we wanted to tell about, you know, a very, like, Carrie not wanting to marry Aiden was one of our writer stories. She was with her partner for 5 years. He proposed. She said no. But they actually made it. At 10 years, she proposed to him. But it was, you know, it was, everything was coming from these personal places for us. And we just kind of kept writing what we knew. I remember when Michael told me for the first movie he was going to have her say, like, that he, you know, Carrie was never going to have kids. I was like, I feel like that's the thing a lot of these women are going to be most angry about, because so many women felt like they were going through what she was going through and trying to find their love partner. And then after that, a lot of those women wanted to have kids, and some of them were struggling with IVF and couldn't have kids. And I was like, I feel like that is going to be hard for some of the fans. So it's like, you know that they're going to struggle with choices you make, but that's the right decision for Carrie, right? Like, it made sense she wasn't going to have children. But I was like, I bet that's going to be tricky for some people.
But by then, you were not working on the show?
So Michael did the movies entirely on his own. He wrote and directed both movies. But we would talk a lot. I mean, I'd read the scripts and we would talk through stuff. And yeah.
And so, you moved on to do what?
So the first gig I did after, I did a lot of development that didn't go. And then I worked on Gossip Girl. And I did season 5 of Gossip Girl. And then while
another iconic show, Amy.
Yeah, no, that was a thrill for me. So Stephanie Savage has been a friend for a long time, and she had actually asked me to do season 1 of Gossip Girl, and it was right after Sex and the City ended, and I just felt like I was like, she wanted me to move to LA because the writer's room was in LA, and I just was like, I was not ready to leave New York. And I just sort of like, I don't know. And they were filming in New York. And I was like, can I? But it was before sort of Zoom or anything like that. And I was like, I'm not ready. And then, oh, actually, that's not true. So right after Sex and the City, I went and did The Comeback. So that's the show with Lisa Kudrow.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wait, that was right after Sex and the City?
A year later. So the Gossip Girl offer came and I was like, I don't think I'm ready to move to LA. And then Michael, he was writing The Comeback with Lisa. And yeah, like a year and a half later, I went and worked on The Comeback, the first season. And I came to LA and I thought, oh, maybe I'll move here now. And then I was suddenly like, oh, I kind of like it with Michael, because I would do anything. If Michael asked me to like whatever Michael Patrick King asks me to do, I will do. And because I know I'll have an amazing time and I'm just working with someone who I admire and I'm inspired by like constantly. So we did the first season of The Comeback and it didn't get picked up for a second season, which I was like completely stunned by. Like because I just thought that show was like, I knew we were doing something really special. And then it got canceled. I went back to New York and then met my husband. So it's like, I guess that's why I was supposed to go back to New York. And then I went to Gossip Girl because I was sort of trying to, we were trying to figure out if we wanted to move to LA. And Stephanie said, why don't you work on Gossip Girl for the season and see if you like LA. And I was like, okay. So Jason was living in New York and we had Ella, she was two. And so I was living, and then weirdly, they wanted to do the Carrie Diaries, which was the prequel to Sex and the City, mm-hmm. following Carrie in high school, based on Candace's book. And Michael was doing Two Broke Girls at the time, so felt like he didn't have enough time. But he said, I'm not going to sort of support this unless it's Amy who writes it. So they brought me on to write it. And Stephanie and Josh actually were my producers on it, who created Gossip Girl. So I was working on season 5 of Gossip Girl while doing The Carrie Diaries. And that was the first show that I created and ran on my own. And that was a lot of work and really exciting.
Yeah, very.
Yeah. And worked with some young actors now who are, you know, Austin Butler, Anna Sophia Robb, like some really, really special actors.
Yeah. You've worked on really iconic things.
It's been super fun. I was just saying this to someone a couple days ago. You know, you work on hit shows and sometimes I was at the time like a baby writer or beginning. I don't like the word baby writer, but I was a writer who was starting out. And then, you know, I've worked on other stuff that I've been the head writer that hasn't worked. So it's like you get to see all these different versions, but they're all really good learning. Like I like what I found is I also really love being in charge.
You learned that on The Carrie Diaries?
I did. I really loved it. Like, I have a lot of friends who are like, don't like it. Love the creative process, love writing, find the running of a show and like budgets and all of that not something that they want to do. And I really love it. I love every aspect of production. I love casting. I love editing. I love playing with budgets. I love figuring out production schedules. I like working with actors and collaborating with them. I love it all.
I think that is rare.
Yeah, I love it. I don't want to ever just write. Like, I really love the production aspect of it so much. Like, I did a show called The Wilds, which, you know, we filmed on beaches in New Zealand and Australia, and I stomping around in my gumboots, you know, freezing my butt off or sweating to death and burning on a beach was like, it's like a dream. It's a dream. Like, it's a crazy, hard dream.
What was it like? And I'm aware as I ask it that I probably wouldn't ask a male guest this, but we're not male.
No.
We're moms and we're mom friends. So I am going to ask what it was like when you had Ellis, your daughter, because production, especially at your level, at a showrunner level, is just so consuming, and how that has been with motherhood.
It's horrible, to be perfectly honest. Like, if I did not have a partner who was helpful and sometimes willing to step back from his own stuff for my stuff. And then we had a babysitter nanny who had been with us since Ellis was 3 months old. So she had this very wonderful support system around her when I couldn't be around. But it's hard. And I would often, you know, like I would be in New York, so it would be midnight and it would be 9 p.m. and she would be getting ready to go to bed at 3 or 4 years old. And she would not let me, and there was FaceTime, but she would be like, you have to leave. She wanted to watch me fall asleep. And she would cry if we were like, let's shut the computer now. Because it's like, it's midnight. I need to go to bed. I have to be up at 5 a.m. tomorrow. And she would be like barely talk. You know, she was like, before kindergarten and being like, no, you have to let me watch you fall asleep. And that was kind of heartbreaking. I spent a lot of Sundays going to the Grove and buying fun gifts for her. And then like at 4 p.m. being like, I have to get on a plane now. Bye. And just watching her face fall, you know. But then there was some lovely moments where, like, I remember someone was always like, tell your kid, like, you don't want to go to work, but you have to. And I was like, I'm never telling her that. I'm always going to say, like, I love you so much, but I have this job and it's really important to me and it's important to our family and I love my job. And one of the things she said to me once when she was very young and like we were handing like our ticket to the parking lot to someone and she goes, do you think he loves his job? And I was like, I don't know, but probably not. but it's paying some bills, and that's important too. And she was like, I really hope I love my job like you love your job. And she was very young. She was like 7 or 8 when she said that. And I thought, okay, I'm giving her, it's hard. It's not always very easy, but, you know, and it's broken my heart sometimes. Like, we mm-hmm. moved to Australia for 8 months, and she didn't have a good, she didn't love her school. She didn't love the shift. It was during COVID. So at least she wasn't totally missing out on school here, because it was a lot of not in person and everybody was in masks. And there, nobody was in masks, and she got to go to but it was, that was heartbreaking for me. I was like, I dragged my family to Australia. We did 2 weeks in a hotel room in quarantine. She cracked her head open day one in quarantine and had to have her head stitched in a doorway because they wouldn't let us out of this hotel room. Like, there was some moments where I was like, God, I hope the lesson she's learning here is that she should chase her own dreams also, and not that I have been so selfish and she hates me for it. So she doesn't seem to.
Yeah, for sure. I think that people who work in the entertainment industry, the way that they talk to their kids about the work, it feels like it might be different than other industries, to be honest. I mean, I don't know, because this is our world. But when we talk to our kids about Jeff having to be away for weeks, sometimes months at a time, and, you know, we don't apologize for it, sort of like what you were saying. We talk a lot about, we are so lucky that Jeff gets to do what he loves. And that so many people in their careers don't, you know, or it's a different kind of balance or whatever. And this is a balance, because it's a sacrifice to be away from your family or to work those kind of hours. But we do try to emphasize that piece with our kids as well.
Look, the question always comes up, like, what would you do if it wasn't this? And I'm like, I legit have no clue. I don't know. Like, this is what I know. This is what I love. And that's really what I want for Ellis. And so my hope is it's not always easy, but I'm giving her a real understanding of, like, chase your dreams. And sometimes you make sacrifices, like, in different places sometimes. And look, sometimes it has been like when we were shooting in New Zealand before COVID, I would fly out on Saturday night to get there for, because, you know, you fly for 12 hours, but it's the Monday morning to be there for Monday through Thursday of filming. And I'd get back on a plane Thursday at 5 p.m. and arrive back in time to pick her up from school. If I hadn't had a kid, I just would have plopped my rear end in New Zealand for months at a time. So I was tired a lot and often, like, struggling with colds and whatever else. But that was the sacrifice I had to make in order to feel like I was there for Ellis. So there is, yeah, it's sacrifices, but you also, I do think, like, the privilege of being able to do something you love is just immense.
Yeah, it's huge.
Yeah.
What would you tell, like, if you had one big thing that you wanted to tell writers? I hear from aspiring writers all the time. It's funny because what I write is obviously totally different. I'm writing memoir, personal essay, personal development, like that kind of thing. But because of the internet, I get people in my DMs and stuff all the time wanting to be screenwriters or wanting, you know, their kid to get a start in Hollywood or whatever. You know, I get a lot of that. And first of all, I'm like, I don't know, because it's way different than when I moved down here in 2001. Like, the world is different. You need to ask someone else. But I am sort of curious what you would tell writers now. It is a different world. There is the internet. The entertainment industry is changing drastically. Like, the publishing industry is changing. Actually, there's just, for writers, no matter what kind of writing you're doing, there's a lot shifting right now.
Well, I sort of have, like, a big thought about just, like, who to be as a creative person, which is, I always say, like, don't chase the money, chase the dream. Which, look, it gets harder and harder as I get older and I have a kid who is in school. You know, you need to make a living. So it's like sometimes you do have to make choices that are more pragmatic or business oriented. But I do think when you write what you are in love with and are thinking about and that is sort of percolating for you, that to me, like, you know, I don't know. researching a topic and falling in love with it and writing a script about that and really exploring your voice, I think, is the most important thing. And I think that actually does bring the money.
Versus starting from a place of like writing a commercial hit.
Yes, because there's no such thing as a commercial hit until it's a commercial hit. There's like a sort of like this idea that there must be an algorithm for a hit show. And it's like, well, if there was, every show would be a hit. Like, you don't know why. I don't know if, like, have you seen One Day, that show yet on Netflix?
No, but I know about it.
Like, I don't think that's necessarily what an algorithm would have pushed out as a hit show. And it's just one, like, I couldn't stop watching. I was like, oh, I'm all in and I can't wait for the next episode. And I was weeping and laughing. And then I go watch The New Look, which is something totally different. And I can't stop watching and I love it. And I'm obsessed. Like, so it's just what speaks to people, but people don't know what they want until they're watching it. So I personally think, like, nobody knew, like, when Darren sold Sex and the City, ABC wanted it and HBO wanted it. And ABC was run by Jamie Tarsus, who was one of my best friends. And I met her after Sex and the City, but she became one of my best friends. And they weren't even sure she ran ABC at the time that they would be able to call it Sex and the City, because that was such an outrageous title for a network television show. So Darren ended up going to HBO, which was, they didn't have a lot of they didn't have any TV shows. Like, it was like they had Arliss and Dream On. Those were like the two shows.
Yeah, it was like pre-prestige TV, really.
Totally.
Or it was one of the kickoffs of that.
It was us, and then Sopranos came a couple months after us, and that was sort of the beginning of HBO. So I think you just have to write what you're interested in. And I think, like, for me, if you want to be a writer, you have to write. Try to get a writer's assistant job in a writer's room, mm-hmm. or an assistant to a showrunner or a head writer. But you just have to be writing and you have to find your voice. And that is not easy. But I think it's a little bit like, if you have something to say, you have something to say. And that's what I think writers are. They're people who have something to say. And I try to always remind myself of that because, you know, I want to make money and pay for my house and school and all of that. But it's like, I have to always remind myself, like, don't just take like my ex-agent who went on to do other things besides agenting, who I'm still very close with, said to me when I was about to take Carrie Diaries on, he said, this is a kind of a no-brainer because it's obviously Sex and the City and you did this, but like, is this a character and a world you want to write for the next 5 years? And these ideas and thinking about it. And I was like, totally. And he was like, okay, then this is your show. Right? Like, and that to me is what was so, like, I have to remind myself of that always. Like, do not pick projects that, like, the idea of walking into work and being like, I don't want to think about. And I did a show, like, I ran a show that was about a serial killer. And I really loved the script, like, loved. And I loved the guy who created it. And I loved all the actors in it. I did not like thinking about serial. Like, there was something, it kind of gave me nightmares. Like, I didn't like thinking and being in those kind of brains. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a good lesson for me. Like, I thought, like, oh, I'll be interested in this. But I actually, like, trying to get under it was like, it kind of disturbed my nervous system. So it's like, I try to remind myself when I'm looking at projects, like, I feel like success for me has been like working on ideas that I'm excited about with people I love. That's success now.
I think it takes a lot of experience and maturity, though, to get to that place, because there's so many routes along the way that you might make a different decision justifiably, like for the money, for a cool project like the serial killer one you said. You might be like, oh, this will be like, I'll stretch my creative muscles. This is a great actor, whatever. And then just being like, I actually can't live in a killer world. It's affecting my mental health. But you have to like learn that.
Totally. And I have no judgment on people who are like, I want that paycheck and I'm taking it, because people have to live. But yeah. What I have felt when I have taken, I'm somebody who in the midst of writing also often is like, I'm filled with sort of self-doubt and nerves and like, I shouldn't have taken this project on. And what was I thinking? And I just like, I go to a very sort of like tense place. So if I take on projects that I really don't like that much, that is exponentially worse for me than even on the projects I love. I go to the sort of place of like, I'm a failure, a fraud. I can't do this anymore. I blew it. I should just go away. So if I'm doing that and I'm actually like kind of feeling like it's not a show I know how to write, then it's not good. Like it really does become, it's just too hard for me.
You're a neurotic writer. I've never met a calm writer.
I know. I just don't even know if it's I don't know if it's possible. I'm sure maybe there are some people out there, but good for them. I'm not jealous at all of that. Good for them.
Do you write every day?
No. And I tried, like I have a really good friend who writes an hour every day, no matter what. Like, even if he's not working on a project.
That's who I want to be, by the way.
Me too. I really tried. I was like, Don Ruse, he's a phenomenal writer. He's like, yeah, I write an hour every day, even if I'm not working on something. And he's like, sets an alarm. You know, he does like, he starts at 10 a.m. and stops at 11. And he said if he's working on something that he has, you know, deadlines on, he'll work for more hours, but he always writes an hour a day. I tried it. I did it like for 2 days. And I was just like, I can't do this. I'm definitely, sadly, one of those people who's like procrastinating, looking at real estate online, like, you know, taking walks with the dog, trying to think things through. And then like I have bursts of writing.
I think it's the Jerry Seinfeld advice, or at least that's where I first heard it, where he's like, write every day, because he was sort of talking about, and I can't remember exactly how he says it. He says it really well, wherever he gave this advice. I've seen it sort of recaptured and reposted, but like, that's what you're measuring, that you did it every day. Like, even if it's bad, even if it's whatever, instead of measuring length of time or word count or page count or whatever, that just you just did it every
day. Did it every day. I know. And it is, I do really think, like, look, I think there's some people who are just utterly brilliant. Like, you look at a Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and you're just like, she's a genius. Like, I just, her, the level of what she's thinking about and exploring, I mean, phenomenal. But it is a muscle. Writing is a muscle. You have to use it in order to keep it strong and keep it moving. Some people are just exponentially, you know, it's like an athlete. Some athletes are just exponentially more talented, but if they didn't do the work, they couldn't stay at that level. So I do think the idea of writing every day is probably like a good thing. I just have yet to be able to land that. Maybe after today I'll try again. I don't know. Maybe. We'll see. I'm working on a couple projects right now. So it's like I am trying to write every day.
I was going to ask you what you're working on now. Is it something that we can look forward to? Are you able to talk about it yet?
So I'm working. So I have a deal at Amazon.
Wait, explain to listeners what it means, because they might hear this and not know, like, people have deals with studios, with Amazon.
Yes.
You might have an overall deal with Netflix. Like, yes. What does that mean?
So Amazon pays me every month, and every studio is different how they work it. But like, I was on The Wilds, which was a show on Amazon that actually was a Disney Studios production, even though it was on Amazon. And so I was working on that show. So Amazon pays me, instead of per episode, they pay me like yearly for a couple of years. I have a deal with them for 3 years. And my job is to develop and get as many shows on the air as possible. And then also sometimes I'll supervise other people's projects who are younger writers, or, you know, who don't have as much experience with production and writers' rooms, and I'll supervise their projects. So sometimes I'll be on The Wilds was not a show I created. Brilliant writer named Sarah Stryker created the show. She'd never been on a set before. So it's a marriage, like, but we met and fell in love with each other. And Jamie Tarzis, who was my producing partner on that, was like, I think you'll really love Sarah. And it was a wonderful fit. You have to, those relationships have to be really good fits. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I find it very upsetting to watch a creator kind of have their show taken away by a showrunner. And so, like, for me, it's very much my job is to, like, train that person to run their own show at some point, if that's what they want. And so, yeah, so Amazon pays me yearly, and I develop projects for them. So they have a podcast through Wondery that I loved and fell in love with, and I'm writing that as a limited series right now. I write the outline. I write the script. They love it. They make it. They don't love it. They don't make it. Nothing is guaranteed in this business, but I'm really excited about that. And then I have another project I've been working on that's still like just in my brain, but it's like a very personal story. So we'll see. But those are the two things I'm focusing on right now.
Is it fun to try and develop things and see what goes or doesn't, or is it demoralizing? I mean, I'm asking because I'm like, it feels like it would be hard. You get excited about a project, even if it's not yours, even if you're just helping shepherd it along, like all these different ways that you're talking about developing something. I feel like it would be hard for me.
It's fun when it gets picked up. Then it's really fun. When it doesn't get picked up, it is a heartbreak that is really hard. I grieve.
Yeah.
I had a show that I loved that I thought was getting picked up, and then the strike happened and everything sort of, the business is going through some pretty scary contractions right now. And they decided not to pick the show up to series. And yeah, like when I got the call, like, and I knew it was the, I was like, okay, the call from this person means it's a pickup and the call from this person means it's not going to be picked up. And I got the call from the person who was like knew right away to just be like, I do not have good news. Like didn't do the hi, how are you? It was just like, Amy. And I was like, hit me, you know, but like your heart sinks down to the bottom of your stomach. And then you're just like grieving, angry. What did I do wrong? Bam. You know, there's a lot of like, it's all, you're all over the map while you're going through your grieving process. Yeah. And then you have to sort of walk away and pick yourself up and be like, that was heartbreaking, but I have to keep going. Cause you know, people are always like, they don't call it show business for nothing. Cause it is a business, of course, but the show is what you love and care about. So you have to kind of grieve letting that go and know, you know, there might be another show down the road that was meant to be. I do try to be very, I don't even know what the word, I try to like slowly metabolize those experiences as opposed to sort of like just immediate freakouts. But like it is, I kind of allow myself in the shower to scream and be really mad about it. And sometimes it pops out later too. Like sometimes you're fine. And then like 3 months later, you'll just say something like rage filled about what happened. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm still feeling really disappointed about that. It's hard. It really is heartbreaking because you have to fall in love with the material that you're writing. Otherwise, you can't find cool things in it. So that's the hardest part. But when it gets picked up, that's the scariest thing. Like that was the thing I never realized until like it was my own show. Like I got my first show picked up. I've never had more anxiety than the day it got picked up, because then I realized like, oh my God, I have to hire the right actors. What if I don't cast it well? And then I took a script that was good enough to get a pickup and I blew it at this, like I remember Larry David saying like the worst thing that ever happened was that Seinfeld got picked up. And then he's like, now I have to do 6 episodes of this. Like, you know, you're just like, and I was like, what an ungrateful person. Like, he's so, what? This is the thing we're all dreaming of. And then when it happened to me, I was like, oh, it's so scary. Because you're also, these budgets that you're working with are enormous and you're responsible for it. So I was terrified. John Wells, who I think he does this amazing showrunners class. He's an amazing man. Like, he's like, I'm in awe of him. And he's like, look, this is a very unglamorous way to describe show running. But if you run a factory and you deliver a product on time, on budget, and it doesn't sell, you'll still get another job running a factory again. If you are out of control with your budget, don't get the product out on time, and it doesn't sell, you're never getting another job running a factory. If you are out of control, not on time, and people buy the product, you'll get maybe 6 months to a year where they keep you in charge and then they put someone else in charge. He's like, so the gig is obviously to get a hit, is to get somebody to love that project. But like, you're a CEO of a company spending a lot of money for people. So like, your job is to deliver a product that is within the bounds of the business. So it's very stressful to figure out how to do that and make the show you want to make, because they never give you the amount of money you want, no matter what. Like, I'm sure the Game of Thrones guys, when they had like 20 million, were like, but we need 30 an episode or whatever. I don't know. But it's just like, wherever you are, it always just feels like you're struggling to like land it. And that's that. But that's also some of the fun of it, I guess, for me, is like how to land it.
Yeah, that is part of the challenge.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to end with one last question that I did not prepare you for, but okay. I think that you're going to be able to answer.
All right, I hope so. Jeez.
I love to ask people to name one book that has had a great impact on their life. This can literally be anything across any genre, any age.
Well, I'm going to sound incredibly pretentious, so forgive me. I am like a huge – I was a Russian major, so I love Tolstoy.
You were a Russian major?
Yeah, I was a political science Russian major. I, like, read a book and then was like, I'd like to be able to read this book in Russian. So I started taking Russian my sophomore year of college. Like, I was very, like, I got interested in something and then I just started chasing that idea. And I love, like, War and Peace is one of my, like, I have taken that book down to, like, the pages. But he wrote these short stories called Boyhood, Childhood, Youth. There was these little short stories and there was this one, like, little sentence in the book, and it was like a child is like in a cart, basically, you know, with a cart and horse, like driving, and they look over and he sees a family farming, and for the first time ever the child thinks like, oh, those people have a life after I leave. I wonder what they do after I drive by. And I always, like, that stuck with me. Like, that's what maturity is like realizing, like, you're on this path and this journey, but, like, there's all these other people in the world who are having their own journeys and paths that you're bumping up against. So that, for me, was, like, a very meaningful, like, awesome book. And then the one thing, the industry book that I have found to be the most, the reason why I love Tolstoy, too, is it's, like, very soapy. Like, it's all war, but it's also, like, romance. Like, and those are my dream books. But the one I love about this business is called The Devil's Candy. And it was all about the making of Bonfire of the Vanities. Mm. And that was fascinating to me because it was before I was totally in the business. I think I was, like, just – maybe I was right when I was getting my first job with Darren as his assistant. And I just – I learned so much about the business and like how like these huge things can go. Like that was supposed to be the biggest hit and it was this huge book and it was a total bomb, the movie. But I loved that book. That told me so much about this business. And like it doesn't matter how talented the group is, like things can just go awry.
Yeah.
It was comforting in a way.
This has been the best conversation.
Oh, I loved it. I hope I didn't talk. I feel like I talked a lot.
Yeah, I wanted you to.
I guess so. I guess that's the point of this.
You just listened to an episode of the 10 Things to Tell You podcast. Make sure you subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app so you never miss a thing. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook at 10 Things to Tell You. And all the show notes for every episode can be found at 10thingstotellyou.com.